This is an ABC podcast.
Morena, kia ora na koutou katoa, and good morning. You're tuning into Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, where our show is produced from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. If it's your first time tuning in, we focus on the Pacific region, talking to leaders, newsmakers and people who make the Pacific Beat. On the show today, how will public consultations go for Bougainvilleans after their election results? Will a snap election in France impact New Caledonia? And PACFest is taking over our social media, probably yours too. It's the good and sometimes the bad. More on those stories shortly. Once our show is done, please find our stories by typing Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. And you can always check us out on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I say whaftai te le lava. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, we start in Fiji, where the country's newest patrol boat, the Puamau, has run aground while on its maiden journey. The vessel was gifted by Australia in March, but was only commissioned for service 3 weeks ago. It was on patrol in Lau waters when the incident occurred. So, joining us this morning for more on what has happened, ABC's Fiji reporter Lithe Movono. Terase yandara.
Yandra Vinaka, Agnes, good to be talking to you again this morning.
Absolutely. This is becoming a very common occurrence, and I really appreciate, the stories that you have been covering there in Fiji. Gosh, what do we know about when this happened and what exactly led to the grounding?
Agnes, the time at which this grounding actually took place is a little bit fuzzy still. The Navy has not said when, but sources, very senior sources within the Ministry of Defense, told me overnight that it happened 2 days ago. So that puts it at either late Sunday or early yesterday morning. However, I did get in touch with witnesses on the ground in Fulanga, which is about 330 kilometers away from the capital, Suva, quite close to Tonga, in fact. And they said that what happened is the vessel was trying to get into a narrow passage that is quite precarious and usually only frequented by very experienced local captains. So right now that vessel, the Puamau, is high and dry on the picturesque lagoons off Fulanga, and what we're told by the Navy very early this morning is that there are salvage teams on their way there now. There is a more specialized team expected to fly to the area later today, but we do have Navy divers already on site assessing the damage, Agnes.
Mm. Well, Lide, I have to ask, is this something like this ever happened before? And has there been maybe any reports of any injuries in this incident?
What we're told is that there have been no injuries to crew. I understand that on the day this happened, there were very strong easterly winds, and that particular passage is well known for very strong currents almost all of the time. And we understand that the ship had been trying for a while to get closer to the island, so people were ready for a situation. No one has been hurt. However, it is hard to find out from the Navy how extensive the damage to this brand new vessel is, Agnes.
Yeah, I was just going to ask then, has there been any word then from the Fiji Navy? Have they said anything about what's happened?
Well, to their credit, they have explained overnight a rather elaborate operation that's already underway since yesterday, at least. We know that a second patrol boat has been sent over to evacuate the crew, and it's taken specialized equipment as well as naval officers who will dive and assess the damage on the reef and to the vessel. We do know, however, that this is not the first time for an incident like this to occur over a similar type of patrol boat. Overnight, working with colleagues, defense journalists there in Australia, I understand that similar patrol boats, and that's the Guardian class patrol boats that were gifted by the Australian government to other Pacific Island countries for a similar purpose, has run aground as well. And so we're trying to find out more from the Fijian Navy today whether other vessels like that in the Fiji Navy have been affected. There is a second sister ship, almost exactly the same as this one, also given by the Australian government in 2020. That vessel, the RFNS Savannah, is still in operation, Agnes.
Obviously, this would halt of a lot of things that they would have to do. What has this been for the public, though? Has this become a bit of an eyesore, or are they just sightseeing, having to watch what's happened? Do we still have Lida there with us? No, looks like she's fallen.
Yes, there is a lot of conversation overnight, Agnes. People are shocked. We are, you know, we're navigators. We come from traditional voyages.
Well, looks like we keep Lida, if you're still there, it looks like we've sort of lost you there for a moment.
Yes, and so there are a lot of people that are, you know, making jokes. But of course, the families of those who are on that vessel are keen to know that their loved ones are coming home safe. We do know that there's a lot of concern over how this could have happened, especially on its maiden voyage, less than a month after being commissioned, Agnes.
Lida, we thank you so much for joining us this morning. Apologies, it looked like you had dropped out a couple of times, but thank you so much for reporting on what's been happening there in Fiji. Vinaka.
Vinaka.
That is our ABC reporter in Fiji, Lida Movono, here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Now, an advisor to the Vanuatu government says the European Commission is pushing through with a suspension of its visa waiver program with Vanuatu despite concessions made by the government. The European Commission made the proposal to make the temporary suspension permanent late last week, threatening to end to Vanuatu citizens' ability to visit the EU visa-free. It follows long-standing concerns that Vanuatu's passports for sale program is being used to facilitate financial crime. But Glenn Craig, the Vanuatu government's special envoy for international development, has previously led an inquiry into the passports scheme. He says the work done by Vanuatu officials has fallen on deaf ears. He spoke with reporter Mackenzie Smith.
We danced to the drum of the EU and we did a lot of what we put in a lot of what they wanted. Triple checks for due diligence, taking away the ability for any, you know, citizens to change their name by deed poll after. Reduce the number of agents by three quarters, so, you know, the list is a lot less. A lot of what they asked for was done. In fact, I think most things were done, but they come back and ask for more, and it's the EU way. We've seen that also with the EU, with their fiscal task force in terms of trying to get us off the grey list. We're off the OECD and the FATF, grey list, but the EU keeps us on theirs, and even them themselves, they go, well, we don't really know why you're still on it, you know, but you are. And of course, that makes our USD correspondent banking difficult. So I think we're suffering a little bit from our political leaders not being a little bit more aggressive around using the voice, the Melanesian voice.
And was there a particular requirement that the EU wanted Vanuatu to meet, or did you get the sense that nothing was going to be enough?
Oh, I don't think anything was ever going to be enough. I quite like the current French, you know, at a personal level, I think the new French ambassador to Vanuatu is quite engaging. He's the EU representative here. He's very engaging. The previous ambassador was absolutely 100% against our citizenship program, right? And at the time that the suspension was first announced, he made sure he wasn't even in country at that time. It was very, like, clear that he was pushing for it. So we see it as French-driven. And then we think that the EU, based on the other changes that they've made in terms of their policy, it's not just Vanuatu that they're targeting. They'll be targeting all of them. So we were just the first. So I think they were never really going to be satisfied with anything we did. And, of course, we're a small island developing state. It's hard for us sometimes to articulate and find the time and the resource. We've got a capacity and, look, frankly, a capability issue sometimes in being able to answer some of these complex questions. But at a pragmatic level, the government had made some real efforts to tighten up where there were glaring weaknesses. And they wouldn't be able to fix all of them. It's the nature of it. You know, we can see citizenship granted to Australian citizens or US citizens or UK citizens where it's turned out that that person has, you know, perhaps shouldn't have been allowed to do so. That happens. But I'd say 90% of the concerns were satisfied. But I don't think there was any real intent from the EU to engage, to regardless of the outcome, to the point of view where they would then take it back to the parliament to allow the visa waiver. I think they need to make someone the example first and then get people used to the idea. And then I think you'll start to see the Caribbean countries will start to happen towards the end of the year. They'll start taking them off the visa waiver. And we've seen it a little bit now, I think, even as an Australian or a New Zealander or an American, they've got their new ESTA system coming in, which you have to apply for an electronic visa online, even though if you're from a certain country, it happens fairly quickly. But they are being more regulated around that visa to get into an EU country.
That was Vanuatu Government Advisor Glenn Craig speaking with reporter Mackenzie Smith.
Pacific Beat.
Well, there's been little movement since Bougainvilleans overwhelmingly voted for independence from Papua New Guinea in a 2019 referendum. Last week, PNG's Prime Minister James Marape told Parliament a moderator would be appointed to help progress discussions before Parliament could look at the referendum results. But on the Bougainville side, work hasn't slowed down, with the first draft of a new constitution already drawn up. And this week, Bougainville's president and a high-level delegation are in Solomon Islands, holding consultations about the draft constitution with Bougainvilleans living there. While we cross now to the Solomon's capital, Honiara, to join National Broadcasting Corporation journalist Calvin Casper for more on those consultations. Calvin, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Look, I understand this planning committee is holding a series of public consultations. What's the purpose of these consultations?
Okay, let me take you back, because after the referendum, there were joint consultations between the autonomous Bougainville government and the national government, and among the one of the consultations, it was agreed that Bougainville can establish, the autonomous Bougainville government can establish a commission to work on the constitution, and that is the reason why a commission has been established. And the reason why they are here in the Solomon Islands is to gather views from Bougainvilleans living in the Solomon Islands into creating a constitution for Bougainville.
Has there been a big turnout though to these meetings?
The meeting in Honiara was launched on Sunday. It was welcomed by the Bougainville Association in Honiara, and there's been a good turnout. Almost 100 people turned out at the Woodford International School in the center of town, and consultations has been continuing at one of the hotels where the commissioners are staying, and people have been trickling in since Monday and yesterday, coming in to offer their views to the commissioners where they're staying.
No, thank you for that, Cameron. What kind of feedback, though, is the committee actually seeking from the public? And is there any way that it could actually help shape this constitution?
There's been a first initial consultation already done in 2002, right after the establishment of the commission. And the commission is now currently moving around with their first draft. So what they're seeking from the Bougainvilleans in the Solomon Islands is some diverse views from people who are outside the region and looking into the region. What would they be? What would their thoughts be on how the constitution should be shaped, looking into the region?
Yeah, Calvin, are you aware of any sort of numbers or stats of actually how many Bougainvilleans are living there in Honiara or Solomon Islands?
I did ask the president of the Bougainville Solomon Islands Association, and they are still working on a number of the exact number of Bougainvilleans living in the region. I understand that there are not so much Bougainvilleans within Honiara, but there are more outside the nine provinces, especially towards northeast and northwest, where they are closer to the Bougainville side of the Papua New Guinea border.
Again, I understand you spoke about the first draft of the Bougainville Constitution. It's already been developed. Again, what's the reaction been to it, though?
I think the reaction has been overwhelming. Bougainvillians have been coming in, either visiting the commission when they've been visited, either within the region in Bougainville itself and across mainland on Papua New Guinea when the commission made its first tour across the country. In the provinces in the country, and they will be doing a second tour across mainland Papua New Guinea, visiting all the provinces again with the first draft for a second consultation, and the reaction has been overwhelming. People have been coming forward and proposing all sorts of views, diverse views, what they wanted in the constitution, and. I think the commission has been overwhelmed with the response by Bougainvillians.
Kevin, you know, some may say that these consultations or sessions may be a bit premature. Is that the case? Because, you know, the matter of the Bougainville's independence has actually yet to be ratified in PNG Parliament.
Yes, that is the debate. Independence Minister for Bougainville, Ezekiel Masatu, is also the Attorney General and the Deputy Commissioner of the Bougainville Planning Commission. I've talked to him about this, raising the similar concern, and his response was that given the joint consultation in Wabeg Town in Enga Province, that was agreed then that between the two governments that the autonomous region can go ahead to establish a constitutional planning commission to go ahead with this activity of writing a constitution. And as per this explanation, the minister feels that it is not a premature work or something that is against the national government.
Calvin, look, thank you for joining us this morning and giving us a bit of insight into that. We will obviously keep in touch with you as this continues to progress. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, Dan.
No worries. That, of course, is National Broadcasting Corporation journalist Calvin Casper here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
While we head to a snap election in France and wondering, will this determine the future of the government in Paris? But for those in the Pacific, it's unclear what impact this will have on plans to change New Caledonia's electoral role. It was these changes, pushed by President Emmanuel Macron, that sparked violence in the French territory just last month. Joe Hulue, the first Canuck to graduate from Harvard University, told ABC's Afinal Fonua there's been a political awakening among young Canucks.
What's your reaction to what's happening in New Caledonia right now?
What I will say is that I think this last month has... I think I'm left with really two overriding thoughts. The first is that I'm always worried about the safety of people on the island, particularly Canuck people, and particularly young Canuck people who have been really at the forefront of all the protesting that's happened in Kanaki. And because my own family lived there, including my own father, there's a personal, real connection to what happens on the ground. And certainly my own family are in areas where streets have been blocked off or there are cordons, particularly in the suburb of Rivière-Salée, which is where a lot of my family tend to live. And it's a part of Nouméa where a lot of Kanak people reside as well. It's made me think a lot about the ongoing fight for and struggle for the self-determination of Kanak people. At the heart of this is really a reaction to France's decision, really, to try and diminish our own political capital within on our own land. And what it does is it sort of acts as a means to remove our ability to have a say on our future as it pertains to our people and on our land. And it really reminds me of how fraught the Accords process has been it shows the power imbalance has always existed between the Republic and particularly Kanak people, and that has persisted, you know, well before the Accords process began, well before the events that happened in the 80s, and certainly well before the referenda that we've had since 2018. I think what this has really done is shown that the movement towards independence has really awakened.
Do you feel that Kanaks are being oppressed in New Caledonia?
I think what this has really shown, and this is my own sort of personal opinion, is that Macron hasn't really been across issues on the island. It's shown that that there's no goodwill between his government and people on the island, and in particular with Kanak people. I think the last month in particular has shown that his mind is elsewhere, and fair enough. He has an Olympics to look after in the next coming months and a bit. And now, recently, he's called for snap elections because of some of the losses his party has made in the EU elections. I think what it's shown is that France have never really addressed the issues that really concern Kanak people with respect and with dignity. And I think it's all come to a head now. It really started during the process of the third referendum when Kanaks boycotted that particular referendum en masse because of the effects of COVID on our people, because of the need for us to mourn the loss of our people, because unsurprisingly, during COVID, we were the ones that lost the most lives. And the decision of the Republic to continue on with that last referendum, I think, really encapsulates their attitude towards, one, the Accords process, which has been going since the late 90s, and I guess their inability to comply with their obligations and responsibilities that are outlined in that process. And I think second to that is that there really isn't a will from Kanak people to seek anything other than their own sovereignty. And that's clearly been misapprehended by the French Republic. And I think the protests have signaled that there is a deep chasm or a separation between us and the Republic. These decisions by the French Republic to dismiss our views, to unilaterally make decisions without our input or without proper consultation that involves us in a meaningful way, has resulted in these protests. The French Republic are solely to blame for what is happening right now.
Does it affect you emotionally, being of Kanak heritage and seeing what's going on in New Caledonia?
As a Kanak, you always feel drawn to your island because your family are there. And the longer these things happen, the more concerned you are for your family. And sometimes you feel slightly helpless. Sometimes it can be frustrating when you see that our perspectives as Kanak people tend to be missing from a lot of the political and media discourse. So that's frustrating. It's frustrating to feel that the direction or the future of your people and your land continue to be determined by a government that is situated some 17,000 kilometers away. And despite living here in Aotearoa, only a 2.5-hour flight, you know, the influence I could have on my own island pales in comparison. And that also feels something I'm particularly frustrated about. But effectively, I'm most concerned about the safety of my people and those on the island. And yeah, there's a deep sense of frustration. But also on the flip side, I want to really emphasize that I'm really proud of Kanak people. I'm really proud to be Kanak and to see that our young people are really taking up the mantle of our centuries-long struggle for Kanak sovereignty.
That's Joe Hulue, Kanak academic, speaking there to Whenau Whanua.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubong. Well, thousands have gathered at FESPAC, the biggest art and cultural exhibition happening this week in Honolulu, Hawaii. While many are celebrating, many Fijians are up in arms over an opening performance that many have deemed to be inappropriate. It's actually divided people on social media. Here to discuss the traditional dance meke, it's Fiji's cultural dance expert, Simeono Sevudurendere. With that, I say bula.
Bula, bula tanaka, aloha here from Otahi, Hawaii.
Aloha. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Mr. Sevudurendere, look, please tell us what actually happened on Saturday. Why has it caused such an uproar? I mean, especially on social media.
First of all, the expectation from many, FESPAC, is to have a traditional dance as an opening act, to present Fiji as an opening presentation. The uproar is due to the performance by a contemporary group from Fiji called WOW, who were tasked to rise to the occasion to perform at the opening because of administrative oversight and flight and visa arrangements back at Suva, which prevented the traditional group from attending to be on time at the opening.
Mm. Well, thank you for clarifying that, because I know that, you know, conversations like this are the very reason there is a FESPAC in the first place, right? I'm wondering then, what was really wrong with showing maybe a bit of a more contemporary performance?
When it comes to Fiji, there is strong sentiment still back at home that to present Fiji, the traditional look, feel, and sound is still the authentic indigenous look, feel, and sound. With due respect to contemporary, the sentiments, the ideas, and the beliefs still that are still maintained. FESPAC is where we go to showcase both contemporary, but also to maintain the traditional and the cultural, and to present as a first presentation, as is in the tradition back at home, everything that is presented culturally has to be the traditional, cultural rendition.
Yeah. So can I ask, what is the actual criteria for a traditional meke then?
Traditional meke, the criteria is always this: the singers or the chanters are always present to sing and provide accompaniment for a group to perform. When moves can seem traditional, but if a group performs to a recording, it changes that paradigm. It is no longer traditional, it is contemporary. Costumes may look traditional, but the key factor for a group to remain traditional is there must be the group, the accompaniment, the singers, the chanters, at the side, singing with the performance. That's the key factor. That's the key criteria.
Yeah, but can I just ask, though, is there enough substance to be able to, you know, taken the criticism that they got? Was it fair enough for people to have to criticize what they brought with, knowing that they were last minute put in to perform on behalf of those who weren't able to make it?
That is the key. Many don't understand the backstory that of this other traditional group could not make it on time. There is value in the contemporary. Oh, they did their research. They also they've grounded the performances. They draw from the traditional and express it in a contemporary way. There's nothing wrong there. It's just perceptions and expectations. The performances themselves, the performance that was shown on the opening, is a good performance in terms of artistic expression. It's just managing the expectations and the perceptions.
No, thank you for clarifying that. Simeone, I'd have to ask, though, then how can Pacific Island countries then ensure the survival of their cultural expressions?
That's the whole idea why we have FESPAC. We have both the traditional and the contemporary go hand in hand, because culture evolves, but in order to move forward and appreciate the contemporary, we must always look back and appreciate the traditional. So that's that platform, bringing the traditional and the contemporary together and moving together and appreciating both the old and the new.
That is absolutely true. Simeon, I do have to ask, you are there in Hawaii. So what are your expectations? What are the things you're wanting to take away from FESPAC while you're there?
The takeaway from FESPAC are many. I'm attending symposium, also seeing the exhibitions, and also the performances. My take home is that we go back home and ensure and embed the learnings, and not just to come here and perform, but to go back and act and action the new learnings, and also in terms of tradition and culture, to empower the young ones, the youth back at home, to express themselves culturally and artistically, whether through a traditional or contemporary dance or visual arts or heritage arts, it doesn't matter, but to raise the level and visibility of the creative and performing arts back at home.
Beautiful words to end off our conversation there this morning, Simeone. We really appreciate it. Vinaka Vakalevu for joining us this morning. That is Fiji's cultural dance expert. It is Simeone Sevudredere here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Just a small gift representing the 100 feet of tapa and mat that we've brought for you.
That is what we call in Tongan mafana, an explosion of colour, pride and love, as the Kingdom of Tonga's delegation, dressed in their national colours of red and white, proudly entered into the opening ceremony of the 13th Pacific Festival of Arts in Hawaii. A 44-strong delegation, led in by Tonga's Bilinsesi, Federica Lupe Uluiva Fatafehi Lapahatuita, came bearing gifts. One of significant size, a 30-metre tapa cloth that captured everyone's attention, gifted to Hawaii's Governor Josh Green. So joining us live from Honolulu, Hawaii, is one of the official Tongan delegates, Mona Lisa Palu. Tera se malo, tau mai pongpongini, Mona Lisa.
Malo lele, aloha.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mona Lisa. I played a little bit there of what happened in the opening ceremony, but I would love to hear from you if you could describe the opening ceremony. What was it like for you and the Tongan delegation?
I think it was a wonderful moment to honor our culture and to share it with our brothers and sisters here at Pacifica. Leading up to it, as you know, there's a lot of last-minute things happening, but at 4 o'clock, the Tonga delegation were already at the Stan Sheriff Stadium, ready to join the other countries who were to be introduced. And so we had sent over that biggest of gift, the tapa, together with our fatufa. And we also had a little smaller gift so that Honorable Frederica could carry it and present to Governor Josh Green at the official opening. But, you know, the atmosphere was just electrifying. There's something about Tongans and the warmth that they feel when they have to represent the country. You know, we're decked in red and white. They were already singing hymns in the background. And I was kind of reminded of how we feel when we go to our national games. You know, we make it red, and the joy we bring from home is incomparable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what I felt even watching through the screen. The mafana, the warmth of our Tongan people came through so vividly. And it's that gifting, though, of that 30-metre long tapa. I mean, can you let us know, Mona Lisa, who made this and how long did it actually take to make?
As you know, this is this is not something that's just presented. It's something that's living in our culture, and that's the additional pride that we have. Tonga feels very humbled that we actually are the remaining sovereign country in the Pacific. And as such, our artifacts is not just an artifact in a museum. It's something that every day is being pounded out and produced in homes and in communities. As you know, that's a Launima, so its worth in money does not reflect the effort that goes into it. Hundreds of people come together and make it. But it's a real process, you know, because it starts from planting the mulberry and then processing it in the sun with the various stages. You know, it takes months and groups to do it. And then finally the painting. And then we had to ship it over. So, you know, customs is not an easy thing, but clearing it and and all that. But when it got here, we were so happy to present it. We'd done that in Guam at the FESPAC. And, you know, other countries bring the best that they can. And we're known for our tapa. We take pride in how huge we can make the tapa. And so we wanted to give the biggest and the best that we could under the circumstances. So we got, you know, normally we don't open it up, because the traditional way is just to fold it and present. But we wanted to show the design and just, you know, the gifting was part of the joy. And we got our handicrafts people to actually hold on to it and carry it together with the BYU students and our representatives. So when we walked in, I was behind Honorable Frederica, and we were going to be very molumalu and calm and walking solemnly. But as soon as we heard the song, the composition by Her Late Majesty, she started to move, and then the whole crowd just started dancing.
And I think that's what was really beautiful, was to see, you know, someone from the royal family obviously feel the mafana, feel the warmth, and be able to lead, you know, her people out onto the crowd there. Again, people are asking, or they want to know, the significance of this gift, because again, I saw everyone holding that tapa and walking in with pride. What again is the significance of that gift?
Well, the tapa for us in Tonga is what is our koloa, is our heritage item, and we have the mats, and it's similar to some of the other countries in the Pacific. You know, Samoa does really fine weaving, but Tonga is known for ngatu, or the tapa. And as I said, it's a process that's done every day, and the products are sold commercially. But the essence of it is that when you go and you have a relationship, or you see your friend, or they have a funeral, you must take a piece of tapa, because that shows your respect for them and that you are sharing what's most important in your household. So for Tonga to come, we wanted to show what's most important for us and what we value, which is the tapa. And we don't want to give just any small tapa. We want to give one that's tapa, made of tapa, without any you know, other materials in it. And we give the best that we can, regardless of how poor we are, of how small we are. You will see the heart of Tonga always give the best that they have. If we had a bigger tapa on hand, we would give even that, because that's how we are. We want to give the best for our host. So we brought it out, and we brought a fatufa, which is also very important, our mat. And, you know, it covered the whole floor, which was kind of, you know, something to see, especially aerial. But afterwards, we had to remind them to please fold it up, because we would block the way for others. But there was such pride to be able to offer what we could to our host. You know, this is a wealthy country, but doesn't matter how poor you are, you always give your best.
That is
and
it.
Tongans always try to share their best.
Malo, thank you, Mona Lisa. Yeah. Look, while you're there, Mona Lisa, I also saw that there was something very personal to yourself that you went to. You attended a gallery, and that there was a photo of your mother, Halaivalu Mangis Balu, you know, as one of Tonga's delegates at the first ever FESPAC in Fiji back in 1972. Did you even know that that was going to be on display, and how much did that mean to you?
That was a very emotional surprise for me. I'm here serving Tonga, and I've been to other FESPACs. So I didn't know that it was happening, and I was just liaising for Honorable Frederica, who had been invited to the traditional leaders event. And the event for Saturday was the opening of the 50th anniversary celebrating FESPAC, and it was curated by SPC. And I remember my mom saying that she, you know, when I told her I'm coming to FESPAC, she said, oh, I wasn't, you know, the first FESPAC, but I kind of dismissed it, which wasn't good. But I thought, oh yeah, yeah. And then I realized that there weren't many people there and how important it was when I got here, because it's the 50th year this year. So as we were leaving, Dr. Koya from SBC came and took us around. And as Honorable Frederica was about to leave for the next commitment, we turned and I saw from the corner of my eye a photo that looked like my mom. And then Honorable Frederica said, "Is that your mom?" And I turned and said, "I think it is." So we went back and I just lost it, kind of cried. It was her after one of the dances. And so I rang her and I just got a bit too emotional, because culture is what I love, and I'm so proud of being Tongan. And of all the photos they could have had, Dr. Koya didn't even know that that was my mother, but they were quite happy that we recognize it. And it's right at the entrance, and on the other side is a quote by Ebeliha Ofa. So I called her, and I saw that the costume she wore when she was representing Tonga is the same costume that we use for one of the dances that we still perform here in FESPAC. So, you know, it's great that the culture is still conserved, but for me, on a personal note, I felt very touched. And yeah, I guess my mom was right. She was at the first place back.
Well, that would have been a very full circle moment for you, Mona Lisa, and yes. What a beautiful story to be told. Can I just take us back, though, to, you know, you spoke a little bit about the making of the tapa. Obviously, there's even the ngatu. Can you describe, I mean, that must be it's a difficult process to make ngatu, right? A very labor-intensive process.
Yeah, so ngatu now, the value has, you know, is quite expensive. But when you think of the labor hours and the resources that go into it, I think it's undervalued at the marketplace. They're experts on it, but I understand that, you know, just growing the mulberry, you have to grow it first. So by one of the outer island groups, they kind of specialize in that. So different regions of Tonga have their different or specific product that they are experts on. And I understand that the hiapo from which the ngatu is made from, or the mulberry tree, is a specialty of Hapai. And, you know, this takes months. And it doesn't become just a woman's work. It becomes a family labor, because now the men, you know, help out. They see the value of it, and they grow they bring it to Matapuinen, and everyone use it. So it goes through a whole process where they have to soften it. They peel back the bark. They have to soften it. They have to beat it, because it's quite narrow, but they beat it and keep beating it, and then to the point where it's quite flat and wide, and those are then connected. There's traditional methods of using it, but now they've incorporated some more convenient ways, and you keep connecting the fitaaki. You know, they become like the white pieces. And you see Rapa Nui and other islands value those, because they come and ask just for the fitaaki, but we take those fitaaki, and the word is not glue, but we connect them to the length. And so they come in different sizes, Launima being like the value, you know, to the higher end, because you can have smaller tapa. You know, I've seen the other countries present the smaller versions, and but we connect it to the length of a football field. And then usually women gather every weekend, and they beat this out and connect it, and it becomes a way of them talking to one another and reconnecting. And there's a day where they all sit down and paint it, and, you know, the proper ink for it, you have to scrape it from a special tree from special areas, and those ink put in, and then way so that it lasts. And then they have to get the proper motifs that suits occasion and lay it out, and then they paint over those motifs, and then they have to dry it, and then they have to repaint. So, you know, it's not something you can make
that's
in a
right.
week.
Absolutely. Mona Lisa, look, we just want to say Thank you so much. Kātaki Beg, because you're cutting out a little bit there from your side, but we just want to say thank you so much for giving us a little bit of knowledge and insight into what it is that you know about tapa making and ngatu making, and obviously representing our Tongan people there in Hawaii. But again, we just want to say thank you for your time this morning and enjoy the rest of FESPAC.
Thank you so much, and we're so glad that you enjoyed Tonga's presentation. But remember, you know, this is how we live. This is the real Tonga. We didn't stage it. This is Tonga.
Thank you so much. Malo apita Mona Lisa ma ufainga Maria ke tatala noe ahoni.
Malo apita ngawe.
That, of course, is official Tonga delegate Mona Lisa Palu here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, you'll find our top stories by typing Pacific Beat in Radio Australia into your search engine. Again, we'll be back at 5 p.m. PNG time this afternoon, but I'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, as always, to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, Otoa Ofaato. I'm your host, Egitu Bol, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.